Hey, this is episode 006 of Champagne Sharks, What Fanon Said, with Dr. Lewis Gordon. The book is What Fanon Said. The author is Dr. Lewis Gordon. And also, don't forget to go to patreon.com/champagnesharks to subscribe to the premium episodes. Once again, that's patreon.com/champagnesharks, no underscores, one word. For $5 a month, you get double the episode, so you can't beat that. And also, go on iTunes and leave a review, not just a rating, but a 5-star review, because that helps the show in the rankings and that helps more people discover it. And that's good for everyone, right? Okay, so without further ado, let's get to it. This is episode 6 of Champagne Sharks, and we have with us Dr. Lewis Gordon, the author of What Fanon Wrote, as in Frantz Fanon. And I wanted him here to kind of break down Fanon for a lot of the uninitiated, or even the initiated who still want a little more context unpacked. So, Dr. Gordon, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And just a small correction. The title of the book is What Fanon Said.
Oh, apologies.
No problem.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we were talking before we started recording. We're talking about, I was saying how I had recently gotten into Fanon. And one of the things I was frustrating about Fanon, but at the same time was rewarding, is how he kind of packs the insights in a riddle. He doesn't just tell you something didactically in the book. He makes you work for the insight. You have to kind of follow him through the digression and see what he's getting at.
Well, I mean, Fanon was a poet, a philosopher, a political thinker, a psychiatrist, and a revolutionary. And throughout, Fanon was also a radical Democrat. So for him, the human being, he was committed to the idea of the human being as an active thinker. So along the way, his concern in all of his writings is about human agency. His poetic elements, however, are designed in such a way to make us see what we often fail to see, because Fanon, as a psychiatrist, was also aware of the mechanisms we have to protect ourselves from, or at least to evade trauma. A very good example in terms of the difference in his writings, and I'm sure you may have seen the contrast between his first published book, Peau Noire, Masse Blanche, or Black Skin, White Mask.
And yes, that's the one I currently read.
Yeah, that's the one that's a very poetic book. And it's a book that's actually based on a long poem he wrote that he decided not to publish. It was actually one of his plays. Yeah, that's another story. It's a play that was premised upon poetry, Dirty Hands, in fact, it was the title. But one of the things in his last work, Le Dernier de la Terre, it's known in English as The Wretch of the Earth, but in my book I explain that's really not, I don't think that's an appropriate translation. The better translation would be The Damned of the Earth, because Fanon's insight in that is an exploration, as one would find in Dante's Inferno, of moving through hell or damnation in a context in which one's innocence is irrelevant.
Now, explain that part about innocence being irrelevant. What does that mean? I think it's a very foreign concept for the American mind to think of, you know.
Well, it's something that's actually not very foreign to what we could say the Black American mind. Because every Black person grows up with a sense that whether you're guilty or innocent is irrelevant. There's already a world in which you're prejudged as guilty.
Yes.
And Fanon talks about that in Black Skin, White Mass. And it's an insight he got also from Richard Wright, because if you look at Richard Wright's not only Native Son, but Richard Wright's The Outsider, both books, although in both books the anti-heroes, the protagonists are anti-heroes, although they committed all the crimes for which they were accused, well, most of the crimes for which they're accused in the books, the interesting part is that the crimes were also crimes of circumstance. And in those circumstances, what the characters realize is that there's a world that already presumes, by virtue of their race, that they would be guilty. But the other part that's interesting, and this is where Richard Wright is also an existentialist, and how Fanon, as an existentialist, connects with Richard Wright, is that, you see, the fundamental issue of life in psychological terms is this weird contradiction. We go through a struggle with achieving adulthood, maturity. But at the same time, many of us fear adulthood and maturity, because with adulthood and maturity, we become responsible for our actions.
Yes.
Now, for Black people particularly, but there are other groups, you know, for instance, First Nation peoples, where there are similar things apply. But for Black people, we already know the history of, no matter what your age, is being called boy, or whatever your age is being called girl, or as we saw in Hidden Figures, that crucial moment when this Black woman who is administrating a community of mathematicians, and even on her own developed a way to do innovations on the IBM machine. She was referred to by the white colleague, the white colleague referred to her by her first name, but she was to answer the white colleague by her last name.
Yeah.
And that's a linguistic way of trying to say one is an adult, but the other one could never be. So
yes.
It was a crucial moment in the film when the white woman answered the Black female character by her last name. Well, the thing about last names there was a point about being treated as an adult. But what Fanon understood very well, and Richard Wright did, is, you see, being an adult is not a case of having our cake and eat it too, because if you eat your cake, then you don't have any cake.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is, adult life is taking responsibility for the good and the bad. It's a world of contradictions. And so what Richard Wright explored was to point out a very crucial and tragic element in his characters. If you look at, if you read the ending, and it's fine for me to bring this up, it won't kill reading the long novel, but if you look at the ending of The Outsider, the character in his dying breath was asked, is there anything he regrets? You know, is there anything that's bothering him? Is there something mm-hmm. he wants to get off his chest? And the prosecutor who had hunted him down expected him to do a kind of confession for his sins. But instead, Damon Cross, the anti-hero protagonist, said the thing that most distresses him was that he was dying feeling innocent.
Mm.
Now you see the point. The idea of looking at children, we don't ascribe to children responsibility for their actions.
No.
So ironically, Richard Wright and Fanon and others tapped into something very, very. It's both tragic, but it's also existentially provocative, which is that if a system says you're not an adult, that you can't be responsible for your actions. Of course, the danger comes in when you cease to have a sense of responsibility for your actions. That
yes.
means that system has erased your humanity.
Because you've internalized it. You've internalized the same lens that they use to view you. You've started internalizing that lens. So you start
right.
seeing yourself through that same lens.
Right, and that's one of the seductions of racism for Black people. This is the thing a lot of people don't understand. We We talk a lot about racism in terms of like white hatred of black people, but we fail to understand that a seduction of racism is to make black people invested in not being responsible for our existence. And yes, this is where we begin to seek a form of authentic, essential self that's incapable of committing wrong. But of course, if you're incapable of ever committing wrong, then doing right is meaningless. In other words, doing the right thing only makes sense if you really can do the wrong thing. So these are some of the existential elements that are at work in people, not only Richard Wright, but he's also seen in Lorraine Hansberry. I've written an essay in one of my books, Her Majesty's Other Children, on Lorraine Hansberry around this very issue. But there are many in the black, we could say the black intellectual or radical tradition who talk about these issues.
Okay, so I want to back up because there was a certain part you lost me. You said when you're incapable of doing wrong.
Mm-hmm. If you're incapable,
who in this scenario is incapable of doing wrong?
Oh, a great example is I'll give you a very good example. When I was in South Africa recently, I was interviewed by a radio program in which a big obsession in South African society is a really stupid debate over whether black people can be racist.
And oh my God. So basically here, they have the same thing here. Yeah.
Oh yeah. This is the whole point. This is one of the seductions of racism. Yeah. So black people get over invested in the idea of making us basically prima facie innocent of anything we do. And white people, there are a lot of white people who think if you could find a racist black person somehow that absolves white people of, several hundred years of racism. Now, the thing that a lot of people don't understand is this. The ability or the disposition of having a racist attitude is not the same as having a license to that attitude. A license to that attitude is when there's an entire system that will support you with that attitude. So the bottom line is that black people can hate white people all we like. There's no system of license that's going to give us power behind that hatred. But white people, even hating black people for a tiny bit, has a whole system, a whole apparatus of license behind that hatred. Now, both could have racial hatred, but the institutional social structures behind and that support that, those are different. And I, in my writings, refer to those elements as license and also institutional or power-structured relations.
Yes, and those power structures create a natural imbalance where even two actions that on the surface seem equal, the whole implication, and because you're only as good as you're in a transactional type of society, because I feel like everything now is transactional as far as politics goes. When everything becomes transactional and quid pro quo, you're only as good as your ability to either punish or reward people. And
well, there is something else at work there. You see, one of the confusions out there is that although people would like to say they're talking about politics, many people confuse morality with politics. And moralism is about whether you're good or bad. But politics is ultimately not about whether you're good or bad, it's what you're able to do, which is very different. Mm. And so this is the bottom line is, anybody who's going to make the assertion that black people have power, and power, often people talk about power, but they don't define it. But power here just simply means the ability to make things happen. Okay, the ability to make things happen and having the material or other conditions that would put that into effect. In other words, to make things happen. Well, the fact of the matter is there are a lot of things black people would like to make happen. but as we could say in the vernacular, it ain't happening.
Nope.
But there are a lot of things when white people would like to make it happen because of the institutions around them. Those things do happen. And that's one of the issues. Those are some of the issues we're dealing with. But the problem with moralism is that moralism shifts it away from the world, from the social relations, from, we could say, the objective conditions to the self. And the thing is, if you're going to put it back onto yourself, then it becomes a discussion about your moral turpitude, how good you are, mm-hmm. you're pure, you're authentic, etc. And we already know that game. I mean, Black people have tried to fix ourselves for a long time, but it's just a waste of time. The other thing with moralism is that moralism often leads to a situation in which it maintains the systems of inequality and domination intact, despite the catharsis of the moralistic individual.
I totally get what you're talking about. And if I can, I want to add an example that I think falls under that. I've noticed right now, right? The big trend in anti-racism is to not talk about white supremacy, but talk about white privilege. And when you talk about white supremacy, right? Supremacy means like I'm supreme over you. I rule you. And it just means something very different. Because when you see supremacy, it's like, okay, listen, I have systems. I have leverage. I dominate every aspect of your life. Whereas privilege, it becomes almost an etiquette thing. Well, first of all, it becomes very moral because supremacy, you need a structure to be supreme. I have to dominate you. You know, whether I'm good or bad doesn't matter. Do I dominate you? But privilege just means, am I just being a jerk? Am I being insensitive? Should I maybe give you a chance to do this time? You know, it becomes almost like an etiquette lesson but it centers the white person.
It's even more. It comes into what Fanon calls narcissism.
Yes.
In fact, you were just heading to it when you said it centers the white person. I mean, it's no accident that white privilege, the discourse on white privilege around race, was created by a white woman. And it was Peggy McIntosh. And a lot of white folks just eat it up. In fact, liberal racism loves it. That's why the New York Times love to have these bleeding heart articles of Black people trying to find creative ways to make white people feel guilty and say, okay, I'm a better white person because I feel guilty. The fact of the matter.
I just want to say this because before I forget the point, what you just said, it's like if you notice a lot of the great anti-racist works of the American canon, it's usually something like To Kill a Mockingbird, where the Black person's suffering is really just there to show how enlightened the white person... Like, it's To Kill a Mockingbird, A Time to Kill, a lot of these narratives is really the white person's journey. The Black person's pain is just there to be kind of the inciting agent, you know, to take them along their journey and make them better white people. And I feel like white privilege falls into that thing where all you're talking about is the white people.
Well, it does, and there's no shortage of Black writers and public intellectuals who are going to offer the commodity of good doses of white guilt for which they get paid. Look, the issue with privilege, there are several issues I have. I actually surprise some audiences when I say, you know, I don't actually accept the discourse of white privilege. I actually offer a different discourse. And first, let me explain why I reject white privilege. First reason is, look at the things that are called privileges. The things that are called privileges are rights to things such as healthcare, being treated fairly if you're pulled over by a police officer, being treated fairly in a criminal justice system, to have access to employment, housing. As you go down the list, you begin to realize it's something weird about calling privileges things that every sane human being would like to have on the planet.
Yeah, those are neoliberal privileges. In a neoliberal mind, that's a privilege.
Well, neoliberalism wants to call them privileges precisely because neoliberalism wants to take them away from everybody, Black and white.
Exactly.
You see? And so if you can get enough people feeling guilty for what they should actually have, then it's easier to take things away from everybody and give more to those who are wealthy. The second reason I have a problem with the privilege discourse, it's a distortion of the concept of privilege. We have often heard the expression, for instance, it's an honor and a privilege to work with you. When you hear something like that, one, the thing about privileges that people don't understand, I mean, who use that discourse, is that privileges are goods. It's a privilege, for instance, to serve if you're patriotic. It's a privilege to be in the company of people you respect. Privileges are actually good things. So the idea of taking good things and tell you you're to feel bad about good things is, Fanon would argue, sick. The third reason I have a problem with the white privileges discourse is exactly what we've seen played out historically. Then it just gave an opportunity for whites simply to talk about their privilege and still not do a damn thing about the system of injustices that are around them and the rest of us. So it bleeds into a form of narcissism. And of course, the thing about narcissism is that one can now puts whites actually back in control, because they could control their cathartic emotional life in terms of how they respond to the charge of privilege. But they go home to a system that remains intact. So what I actually argue is a more constructive way to deal with this issue, and I've already hinted at it, is the concept of license. Now, people may say, well, what do you mean? Well, if you think about the very basic thing of what a license is, when you get a license, it means whatever you're doing is protected by law. You see? So what happens is, in mundane examples, for instance, if you have a license to drive a car and you're pulled over, if you show you have a license, that is established that you are rightfully driving a car. Whether you have done other things while driving the car is another matter. Now, here's the thing. The thing about license is that a license is a form of legitimate right to use a certain power. So what happens is, if we think of the most extreme example of how a license works, try to imagine a license to kill. If a person has a license to kill, and in many contexts, many people, when they're designated soldiers or mercenaries, have contexts in which they have a license to kill. Now, let's just say you were born with a license to kill, say, all except other people with a license to kill. You got it?
Yeah.
If you're in a framework like that, that means as long as you're killing anybody outside of the category of other people with a license to kill, then you don't have to give a reason for the killing you've done. You just have to show your license.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you think about it historically, that's the extreme example, okay? Well, if you look at the history of white supremacy is a history of large communities of white people. They could pack a picnic basket, get together, drag a black woman or man or child or a Native American man or woman, but it was predominantly black men and women. There are other contexts in which large Native populations were wiped out. But the main thing was they could drag these people, they could eviscerate them, lynch them, you know, string them up a tree, burn them, and throughout the entire process pose for pictures that are put in newspapers with them committing those acts.
Some of them are even postcards.
Correct.
And it's even scarier when it's a postcard, because it's not even in an envelope. It's showing. So that scene is traveling across how many eyes?
So when you think of that example, if that's not a demonstration of a license, you see what I'm trying to get at?
Mm-hmm.
Because it means that the legal authorities will not act upon that precisely because the perpetrators have, and the license here, of course, becomes the designation white.
Yeah.
So exactly. Whiteness functions, and we know that whiteness is not ultimately about color, because there are people who have been actually browner than some black people, but are legally designated white and able to work within the framework of that license. Now, I give you one more example that's really crucial because of the contemporary debates. one of the ways in which there has been a form of fascist attack, particularly on Black people and on women generally, but as well, is this phony defense of free speech in a war against political correctness.
Oh my God, that's so tiresome.
However, if you look carefully, they're not actually defending free speech and what they call political correctness. And you have to pay attention to this. The political correctness is a term developed by the American right.
Yes.
It's a right-wing concept, just like white privilege was developed by whites.
Yes.
And the reason this was a way in which the right wanted to undermine the efficacy of political institutions. But if you look carefully at what they call political correctness, it's not actually political. It's moral. In other words, the examples they would use is if people are going to judge certain people as immoral for the things they say. That is very different than politics.
Yes.
And if you think about their defense, because at the end of the day, you know, get some spine, just argue back if people are going to say that they condemn what you say. However, what's striking is if you look at what they're fighting for, it's for the reassertion of legal apparatuses, of structures that will actually give them not free speech, but licensed speech. In other words, licensed speech is to be able to hurl your words in an act of harm.
Yeah.
And licensed speech, the way I usually formulate it is, a free speech doesn't mean the right to be a schmuck. Free speech is an adult responsibility to communicate with others in a world that actually expands the capacity of other people in terms of human flourishing. However, the childlike, adolescent, licensed speech comes down to a simple thesis. I just want to do or say whatever I want.
Yes.
Now, of course.
And it's a kind of childish at its roots, too. It's a very childish, because that's what a child says. Like, I'm grown and you can't tell me what to do.
Yeah, do whatever I want. Now, here's the thing. You know, it's defended to the point where saying and doing whatever you want can in very real ways lead to not just harm, but death of others. As we know in the famous Emmett Till case, for instance, the woman who was the testimony and who around this man's death, her words were used for the lynching of this boy. He was 14 years old.
Yes.
And there are many other examples. If we look at Trump, Trump is not about free speech. Trump is the manifestation of the adolescent fantasy of many whites to return to a world in which they had the license for liberty without responsibility.
Yes.
Now, And this is the thing that many people haven't meditated on, but this comes back to Fanon, because Fanon understood the distinction between liberty and freedom. As a therapist, for instance, a patient would come to him precisely because although the patient may have liberty, that if the patient has insufficient control or understanding over her or his life, and the relationship that person has with the social world, that person's freedom will be impaired, although there are no formal shackles over her or his hands or feet.
Mm.
And so this is the crucial thing that's missing from a lot of, particularly American or Anglophone discourses around issues of freedom and around discussions of racism. And this is the insight that we opened up with, which is that there is in freedom always a responsibility and a demand for one to take on the task of carrying the burdens, if you will, but they're not burdens in a negative sense.
Burdens.
They're burdens in the elective
yes,
sense.
Yes.
In the good sense, or what's called in the Bible, election.
Yes, because in the good all burdens aren't bad. And if you believe they are, that becomes a very narcissistic way of thinking. But
right, not all burdens are bad. There's certain burdens that are a function of the responsibility that make us into better human beings.
Exactly. Exactly. And you touched on something that I want to revisit. You said something about, especially under the Anglophone system, these values especially persist, and it's hard to see outside them. But one thing that I've been grasping from Fanon that I think he touches on very well is that as a Black person, you most need to be able to step outside of that Anglophone lens, but you're also the most likely to subscribe to it, you know, because you come into that education system with a feeling of inferiority. So you're the one who most needs to be able to have an alternative lens, to be able to see outside of that white frame, but you're also in the worst position to ever be able to do it. And similar to what you said about the Peggy McIntosh, like I've seen two Black people argue racism, and both of them are citing Peggy McIntosh instead of their own. instead of channeling their own experience, or maybe a Black scholar, you know, and they were both very highly educated, Ivy educated people. And they were just arguing Blackness and whiteness to each other using white papers.
Well, this is something I've actually written quite a bit on, which is that there's a tendency in the academy to treat theory and any legitimating resource as white and make Blackness the world of experience. And so what happens is that you find Black people try to explain our experience through the theoretical resources almost exclusively of whites.
Yes.
The problem, of course, is that the way I formulate it in a book called Existentia Africana is that everybody has the experience of trying to figure out her or his experience. And what you usually do is you go to another person and you work together to bring a theory or meaning that to the experience. Now, what this tells you is that when you go to whites for theory, and this is not to say that the theory offered by whites is intrinsically bad. It's just that we forget that those theories were developed by whites out of their experience. So in effect, then,
I'm sorry, hold on. Your last sentence, I think, might have broken up. So can you repeat?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. The thing that we often forget is that the theories developed by the people who became whites or Europeans, the theory was developed out of their experience. In other words, they too had the experience of trying to figure out their experience. The problem then is if we seek exclusively their theoretical resources to bring meaning to their experience, to bring meaning to ours, we are in effect saying their experience is more valuable than ours.
Exactly.
In short, what we need to do is exactly what anybody should do when we're trying to figure out our experience, which is we should develop the theory that would bring meaning and understanding to our experience. And it may mean drawing on quite a few people, but we shouldn't exclude ourselves from the reservoir of materials we'll use to understand the world. But there's some other things I would like to add to this reflection.
Yes.
There are two things. The question you are asking touches upon an old problem that was raised not only by W.B. Du Bois, Antoine Fermin, Frantz Fanon, Richard Wright, many others. It's the problem of double consciousness. And what the problem of double consciousness is the presupposition that you can only see who you are through the eyes of those who condemn you.
Yes.
So in effect, the way Blackness is defined is through the eyes of those who are anti-Black. However, there's a certain point at which one begins to realize that maybe the problem isn't that I am Black or from a Black person. Maybe the problem is a society that constructs black people as negative.
Yes.
If you make that move, you move to potentiated double consciousness. And if you make the move to potentiated double consciousness, you're in a dialectical relationship with the society in which you are able to see its contradictions. Now, this is very crucial because this is actually what you'll find in Du Bois's, for instance, Black Reconstruction. You'll find it in his works on the world in Africa, but not just there. You will find this in Antonia Fermin's The Equality of the Races. You'll find this this insight of looking at those contradictions in Anna Julia Cooper's work. It's definitely in Fanon's work, especially in Le Dernier de la Terre. And this is what Fanon pointed out. You see, what racism and colonialism attempt to do is to create a Manichaean world. And that's a fancy way of saying a world of separateness,
yes,
segregation, mm-hmm, apartheid. In other words, the argument is that if the black is the opposite of the white, then the two cannot meet. Mm-hmm. So the white becomes a universal and the black becomes a universal negative. The problem with that is that that's not a human world. A human world is a world of interaction, which means the human world has contradictions. So what Fanon noticed was that what it would take to maintain a world of contraries, a world of segregation, a world of separateness, would be resources that would actually create a false notion of purity. You would literally have to make a world in which not only do you not see, if you are white, black people, but you cannot even think of black people.
Yes.
You could see how absurd that is.
But now, you see hints of that, and when people say, I don't even see your color, or I don't even see race, yeah, like they're kind of tapping into that absurd notion.
Yeah, it's complete nonsense. Yeah. I usually compare it with a gender example. The gender example I give is this. A man and woman goes on a date. They have a great time. At the end of the date, the man says to the woman, I had a great time. She said, I had a great time too. He says, there's only one thing that can make it perfect. What? He said, well, I could respect you. I could really connect to you if I ultimately can't see you as a woman. And I usually ask audiences, do you think he's going to get a second date? And, you know, they pretty much know the answer because they know that a man who needs not to see a woman as a woman in order to respect her is a misogynist.
Exactly.
Yet that's what we treat as a standard of what white people are supposed to have in their minds when they see black people. They're supposed to not see us, yeah, which is absurd.
And that to me, that comes from the idea that that sentence only makes sense if both parties agree that the category is a less than category. And it shows the degree to which black people accept the idea of themselves as less than. Like, it's not uncommon for a black person to date a white person and ask them, hey, are you okay with black people? Is your family okay with black people? But the white person will never think to say, hey, you know, are you okay with the fact that I'm white? A lot of times they just assume that their value is being brought to the table.
Well, this leads to the next part I wanted to get to. The reason I wanted to get to this is there are two things. The first thing is, if we get back to Fanon as a therapist, and by the way, Fanon was two kinds of psychiatrist. He was a forensic psychiatrist. He was a clinical psychiatrist. Yes. The forensic psychiatrist part, we could talk about it in a different, another time, yes, but that's basically a medical detective. But at the moment, we're talking about psychopathology, so I'm talking about him as a clinical psychiatrist.
Yes.
And what the first thing to bear in mind is Fanon is very precise in his words, and he makes a distinction between when he sees someone as a patient and he sees someone as a client. Now, people would say, why is that a difference? Because, you see, for Fanon, if a black person comes to him in a racist society and that black person is angry, Fanon calls that person healthy. You see what I'm trying to get at?
Yes.
In other words, the problem Fanon was saying was that his training as a psychologist and a psychiatrist put him in an absurd situation.
Yes.
The absurd situation is supposedly cure a black person who is angry about racism.
Yes.
But that's in effect to create a happy slave.
Dr. Gordon, point there, I think you might be taking for granted how heavy a point it is. So I don't want you to move on from there yet, because I think that's a heavy point that should be expanded on. That the idea, because if I understand what you're saying that medically, as far as medicine goes, the goal is I have to get this person relieved of tension. I have to get this person functional and happy. So from a medical aspect, he's supposed to think, you know what? I can wake up every day and look forward to going to work and school and dating in this white supremacy society and be okay with it. But from a client psychopathology aspect, you're thinking, okay, the same response to a dysfunctional world is a dysfunctional response.
Well, we could put it this way. Yeah. It would just for some of the listeners should even think that there was a medical term. There was a so-called pathology called dreptomania. Are you familiar with dreptomania?
It sounds familiar.
Dreptomania was the illness that masters actually wanted their slaves cured of the desire to flee and seek freedom.
Yes. You were considered to be an unwell slave if you wanted to escape the plantation. And that experts come to the plantation. Yes, that's what I thought. And that experts come to the plantation to treat their slaves. Like, why do you want to escape? What's wrong with you? It's kind of like a dog that keeps running away from home, and you get the dog whisperer to come. Whereas someone who's a naturalist would think, hey, of course a dog wants to escape. He's not supposed to be wearing a sweater.
Yeah. Well, so Fanon's point is very straightforward. He says it in his psychiatric writings and in his political writings. You see, there are, because he was a psychiatrist, there are actual real mental illnesses that are independent of racism. For instance, if you have neurological damage, if you have, I'm an epileptic. If you have epilepsy, that's a real. You know, that's a psychophysiological thing.
Yes.
However, that is separate from the social situation in which one is dealing with a world that actually tries to make you believe you're not a human being deserving of respect. And what Fanon argues there is, of course, you're feeling sick precisely. You're feeling sick because you are actually well. In other words, it's actually a sign that you're saying. Correct. And so what Fanon says is that the real response to that is not to make you happy with racism. The response, Fanon says, is to make you actional. In other words, Fanon says the right response is to have a positive outlet for legitimate anger. And for Fanon, that means being politically active. It means standing up for yourself. It means dignity. It means going out in the world and doing whatever you can that's part of a struggle that's greater than yourself. So for Fanon, it also means getting rid of narcissism and understanding that fighting racism is not about you. It's about a whole world that's greater than you, but for which you play your action plays an important role.
Yes. I'm going to give you a similar example that I think relates. I had a recent podcast about the show Hamilton, and part of the problems I had with it about having black people play slave traders and celebrating these people. And one thing that was interesting that I brought up is I had several people, including black people, come to me and tell me before this musical Hamilton came, I had trouble getting black kids to get excited about the founding fathers and to feel connected to the American founding and the American history. And Hamilton is a good thing because now it has kids, you know, looking up to Thomas Jefferson and looking up. And I was telling this woman, I was telling her, why is it a good thing for a black child to look up to a man who raped a 14-year-old slave? up until he died and impregnated her several times. Like, to me, that's a problem that it actually gets the kid to look up to that person. Like, you know, someone who oppressed their ancestors.
I'd much rather a world of black kids and white kids and brown kids looking up to Frederick Douglass and Toussaint d'Ouverture.
Yeah, no, totally.
And Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. And I could go through a long list. I'd rather them think about Benjamin Banneker, Lemuel Haynes. These are people whose names that every American should know.
For sure.
These are, you know, I'm speaking to you from the town in which Lemuel Haynes was born. He was a revolutionary black philosopher from the 18th century. And he called out the fact that the black people were being sold out in the War of 1776.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many people. For me, it's very important that there are young women and men who are inspired by seeing that iconic image of Angela Davis with her afro standing up tall, speaking to the man.
But I think even if you're going to look up to white heroes, can you imagine if the musical was about John Brown? I mean,
I know. Or for that matter, Cassius Clay. You know, a lot of people don't realize who Cassius Clay was. I know that there's that many people now know the name through Muhammad Ali.
Yes.
But they don't realize that Cassius Clay was an abolitionist.
Yes, yes.
And he was a fighter. And he was a fighter. He actually fought. He was stabbed several times, shot even, and kept fighting. And he stood up for what he believed, and he was run out of town. And it's so. And I, in an article I wrote on Muhammad Ali, I said, ironically, that Cassius Clay was the white Cassius Clay. Would have actually supported the idea that Muhammad Ali changed his name to Muhammad Ali, from Cassius Clay.
You're saying he would have liked the idea.
Yeah, yes. Because for him, he wasn't fighting for the freedom of a paternalistic freedom.
Yes.
The idea, if you're going to name a black kid off of a white man who's a fighter, then that black kid now has the freedom to fight even that white man. And and so in a way, it was consistent.
Yes, he wasn't like Bill Maher dealing with Cornel West. You know, there's certain white liberal paternalism, which is like, you owe us. They see Bill Maher telling Cornel West, you know, you owed us to vote for Hillary.
I got to tell you, I watch the comedy shows because right now they're one of the few places you can actually get truth in journalism is in comedy. But I got to tell you, it's really pathetic the way the coterie of black public intellectuals are paraded on those shows.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And a lot of people, you know, we're in a period right now where people are so obsessed with the question of being in the public eye and stardom and all of that stuff that we're forgetting, you know, that we're forgetting the larger picture. And part of this is the danger of the dialectics of recognition. You know, Fanon, you could not even imagine Fanon on one of these shows. It would be an absurdity.
I agree. And you know what's funny? I'm reading Fanon as I'm watching these shows, it makes me think Fanon called all this so many years ago, and we're still going through it. And why would he be thinking to comment on this now? He'd be having a ball.
Well, Fanon has an interesting chapter on language in Black Skin, White Mass, and it's an issue to which he returns in a few other contexts. But it's a very simple point, which is that Fanon basically warns against the dialectics of recognition.
Yes.
Right? That what racism ultimately fears, what a white racist ultimately fears, is not whether black people hate white people, because at least if you're hating white people, you're telling white people that you're centering them. They have the power over you.
You still matter.
But what really scares the crap out of racists are black people for whom white people are irrelevant.
Exactly, apathy.
In other words, it's not exactly. It's even a little more than that.
Even more than apathy.
You know, one of the ways, it's something very different because you see, in other words, one of the things about black folks that's not often talked about when we talk about racism is we always talk about black folks so much in terms of white folks that we forget to talk about how black people live in black worlds. And one of the things that that I remember not only in my childhood, but also I get the good for the privilege in the good sense of witnessing, because I go through the continent of Africa, I go through the Caribbean, I go through South America. Unlike certain people who, when they do get to go to these places, they often stay in five-star hotels. Yes. And there are literally black people, I got to tell you, who go to Africa and don't meet any black people.
Sure.
Because they're brought by white people, they stay with white people, and they get on a plane and they come home with white people.
But not just that, they look at the black people through the eyes of white people when they're on that island. Like, you know, they get as scared as when a black person shows up as a white person does.
But if you go to black places, and not just in Africa, if you go to the South and different parts of this country, if you just go in black communities, okay, one of the things that's not talked about, and this is because the old moralistic white guilt stuff don't even want to address this issue, because at least the moralistic white guilt stuff centers white people, is the fact that most black people live our lives not thinking a damn thing about white people.
Yes.
A lot of us get up in the morning, we don't brush our teeth and look in the mirrors and get pissed off that there's a black person looking back. There are a whole lot of beautiful things about being black in the world that we enjoy, because that is our lived and cultural experience. Yes. So, for instance, the way a lot of black folks just ordinarily listen to different forms of black music, the foods different black people like, and I'm not trying to create a singular authentic sense of black people, because as we know, there are black people who are more Caribbean oriented, there are black people who are Muslims, there are black people who are Jews, Christians, there are black people who are atheists. So there's a whole world of black people. But one of the things that I've seen, especially when I'm in places like parts of Kenya, or I'm in the black townships, or Soweto, you know, if you go to South Africa, a lot of people would talk about Cape Town and, you know, the more like white Mecca and places. But if you go to South Africa, you go to a place like Soweto, and everything around you is just black businesses, black, et cetera. And you don't have to like call it black. It's just there.
It just is what it is.
Saying? So it just is what it is. And you see people just kicking back, drinking beer, talking, laughing. It's beautiful. Or if you just, and talking politics, or even just arguing around all kinds of issues, that is wonderful. Or when I sit down, me as a philosopher, as a scholar, there are times I don't only research into racism and colonialism, but there are times I'm just trying to study the human condition. And the fact that most black people don't even know that it's right out there to get hold of. 2,000 years of philosophy on the African continent before the first Athenian philosopher or Ionian philosopher bothered to make an abstract reflection. Yes. And so I, for instance, I've taught classes. I'm well versed in what we call a European tradition, but I also teach Asian and African thinkers and thought. And I also spend a lot of time in the global South, where I'm able to see the resources and learn from people from Peru to Argentina to Colombia, from South Africa to Senegal to Kenya to India, all the way through to the Maori brothers and sisters I hang out with in New Zealand. And the thing is, everywhere I go, people have something to teach you. There's stuff you can learn. And the thing that struck me, though, is, you know, there's a point in my career where it really hit me. I taught a course recently where the students and I sat down and went through nearly 5,000 years of philosophical thought. And everyone we read was either African or of African descent. And this was without a nationalist agenda. It was purely and simply because there were some questions we wanted to look at, and those were the people who addressed those questions. That's a beautiful thing. And that, and that, you know, it wasn't about trying to set as the measure of who I am the question of how I measure up exactly to a white person. And this is something that scares the crap, because you know what black people who don't look at white people and say, how do I measure up to you, are called? We're called arrogant.
Or uppity.
You know, or uppity. Yeah, or we both said it at the same time, or uppity. Or a few other things. And, you know, the field comes in, which points to a rather recent reference.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's true. But, okay, looking, you've said so much, I don't even know where to pick up from. But I'll say this. What you described about how a lot of white liberals, or white people in general, can't imagine a world where black people aren't always censoring them. Like, you know, can look in the mirror and not think about how ugly they are compared to a white person, or how this they are compared to a white person. But something that I've been growing to realize as I get older, there's a lot of black liberals or black people or black conservatives, whatever, who also can't fathom that. Like, there's black people who, maybe because they only grew up just surrounded by white people, whatever, they even can't fathom that there's a life where black people interact with black people and aren't thinking about white people. Like, I also one last thing. I was watching this show called Dear White People, and I feel like the person that created the show kind of came from that mindset. And he had a character walk into a black barbershop, and it's a black kid going first year in college, and he's scared to death to navigate the black barbershop, which to me is the most natural experience on earth, is to be in a black barbershop. And it really blew my mind. I was like, wow, he's looking at this like a white person who went to a barbershop for the first time. He's that internalized the lens. And it was...
Well, that's someone who stuck it. Yeah, that's someone who stuck in first stage of the consciousness. I mean, the political thing, you know, Fanon makes a distinction between the recognition issue. You see, the problem with the recognition issue is it's about who's a standard. Now, if someone tells you you're not a human being, right? The danger that it poses is for you to respond, what are you talking about? I'm as human as you are. The problem is you'd make the person who challenged your humanity the standard. Now, suppose you say, wait a minute, what gives you the right to be the standard? You know, should racism, sexism, homophobia, should, you know, poor be the standard? So you say, well, I'm going to try and find a higher standard. But the thing is, you see, you don't by fiat just make yourself the standard. Standards are something human beings strive for as what we are as a species. But the thing that becomes very, very problematic when we get locked in these recognition discourses is that these recognition discourses lock us into the moralistic ones as well. And here's the thing. Why Fanon scared the crap out of a lot of people. What Fanon basically pointed out is that what colonialism and racism have done was to create a situation in which it has made it legitimate for black people not to appear. So this means that if you're trying to transform a system, transformation can only emerge through appearance. So in effect, your very appearance, your very effort to transform that system would be considered a violation of decency, legitimacy, and justice. In effect, then, what racism has done is rendered almost irrelevant the integrity of those categories. What Fanon says you have to do is you have to fight, you have to be political. And when you're being political, you have to just accept the fact that standing up for your dignity, respect, and transforming the world is going to receive the criticism of being violent. But the reality is that the only thing those who are unleashing that criticism will accept is for you to do nothing at all. So in effect, then, the big issue is to start using our creativity and our ability to work through a world socially and politically to lead to those changes. One thing, though, I have to say is that I'm also critical of the way we do talk about liberals in the society. And part of it is that I think the reason people talk about liberals a lot is because liberals you could talk about moralistically. You see, the conservatives On the other hand, they don't actually respect those norms. So they can be as brutal as they want, as we're seeing now with Trump, Bannon, and all these people. The fact of the matter is, the problem with liberals is the moralism means that they have to tolerate the very people who will abuse them and us. So this is one of the reasons why that liberal-conservative dichotomy, I think, is a problematic one if we're going to deal with issues around, particularly issues of racial justice and social transformation. And part of that is because if you go back to that discussion we had about colorblindness and all of that before, the problem with now philosophical liberalism, I'm not talking about ordinary political liberalism, I'm talking about philosophical liberalism, is that philosophical liberalism created a fiction, which is an individual that can exist as an individual completely independent of a system. The problem with that is that no black person has ever been discriminated against as an individual. We're discriminated as part of a group.
And not just that. So a lot of times when we get discriminated as what seems like an individual thing, even then, it's still collective. Like, if you assume that I can't pay for this meal, yes, that's an individual slight against me, but it came about because of my collective status as part of the black collective.
Correct. And so what we need to have is what is a conception of how, well, it's more than that. We need to understand that political reality is about groups. It's about institutions. It's about structures we can transform. And if we think back to that distinction I made between license and freedom, license and privilege. Privilege is about you can whine about yourself, but a license is something you could get together and deal with, changing legal structures, collective mechanisms to get rid of those licenses. No one should have a license to kill people. No one should have a license to lynch people. No one license can be connected to things that are patently bad.
Exactly.
And so ultimately, if we want transformation, we need to get rid of the license of white supremacy.
Yes, because even slavery, if you look at slavery, they weren't breaking the law. So the Dred Scott case, someone could argue that was actually legalistically, he had a license to have him back. He had a right to have him back. But morally, it's very clear what the right decision is. And people do conflate the two, I think.
Correct. But and you see how different our conversation became once we began to make that distinction between privilege and license?
Yes.
And the other thing about license is, for me, oppression is not something I want to own. It's something I want to get rid of. So at the end of the day, the thing about license is at least that's something people from any racial or ethnic background or class structure can do something about. But the guilt stuff is something that's left for whites to do in their own private masochistic displays of narcissistic guilt.
What you're saying is absolutely true, and I think Fanon taps into why we can't just leave them to work it out on their own. And it's because what I like about Fanon is that he's very in the psychoanalytic tradition, and he's very Adlerian. You know, which I'm a big fan of Alfred Adler, and he just talks about how like black people are codependent to white people, like, and a codependent. Let me just finish this thought and then I'll pass it to you.
Sure.
I feel like when you have a certain codependent way, you have trouble defining yourself outside of the narcissist and his dramas. And one of the ways you get value, because a narcissist weaponizes their attention. And I think white people are very good at weaponizing their attention. You know, they know how to get, you know, for example, like, look at Michael Eric Dyson caping for Bill Maher, like standing up for Bill Maher, or going attacking Cornel West, who was a longtime friend and mentor for a long time. And over Hillary Clinton, Cornel West writes this really long screed against him. And I think, and this is something that Fanon talks about, we get kind of addicted to white attention. You know, like, it takes something like Oscar So White, and you can win 10, 20 black awards, but you don't matter until you win the one that matters to white people.
Well, there are several things there that we should consider. The first thing is what Fanon does is Fanon is very, very explicit that not everyone is in the framework of the pathologies he's talking about. So for him, not all white people are that way, not all black people are that way, which is why I wanted to make sure to point out that there are black people who live in a world of positive blackness. Yes. Now, the second thing is, I actually argue that Fanonian psychoanalysis is his own. I usually bring it up through an example. Some people say Fanon wasn't properly a psychoanalyst because he wasn't trained as a psychoanalyst. And I often respond by asking them, who trained Freud?
I totally agree. I totally agree.
Freud, in his interrogation of certain problems, created Freudian psychoanalysis. But Freudian psychoanalysis wasn't a psychoanalysis about colonialism and racism. Fanon's is. Fanon did his own psychoanalysis. In fact, the fifth chapter of Point Noir, Masque Blanc, or Black Skin, White Mask, is an excerpt from Fanon's self-psychoanalysis. Yes. Now, the other thing in terms of the codependency issue and those, the thing is, those for Fanon are social maledictions. That's for the sick. And the thing about that is that the society tries to make black people believe that we're supposedly authentically black if we're sick, which of course creates a problem, right? The problem is to be a healthy black person is considered an illness.
Yes.
So it means you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. That's Fanon's point. It's a waste of time there. That's why he's very concerned about being mature and actional. Yes. In terms of And when we think about there's so many issues at once that you brought up, from the Oscars to many other things. But here's something I'd like you to consider, and this is when we're talking about value. And I think this, see, it's very important for us to look at where black people actually got certain issues right. And this is, there are many examples of this, but I'm just picking one. There are many others. I'm the person in charge of, I chair the awards committee for the Caribbean Philosophical Association, and I always give a speech when we are conferring the awards. Now, I can't nominate people, I don't vote, but I'm in a position to administer the prize. And what I open up with is a speech about this that connects to what you just said. The speech basically says that our award is a statement not only that we value the recipient, but it's an invitation for the recipient to value being valued by people from the global south, by people who are predominantly black. Now, you see what I'm saying? And it's powerful how many people who have received the Frantz Fanon Award or the Nicholas Guillen Award or the Anna Julia Cooper Award or the Claudia Jones Award, when I visited some of these people, and some of them are really quite famous people, they've gotten all kinds of stuff. I walk into their homes, and even though they've gotten MacArthur's and all kinds of other stuff, in some cases, there's one person who had the Nobel, I walk in right there. I mean, like the moment you open the door, there is the Frantz Fanon Award, or, you know, like
that is beautiful.
Yeah. Right? So it really is. Now let me put it back to something because today is a different context, but put it back to the 19th century. You know, Frederick Douglass wrote three autobiographies, right? He started with the narrative of Frederick Douglass, then he did My Bondage, My Freedom, and then he did The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. Now, when I read the narrative for Frederick Douglass, I noticed something very peculiar, and I had a hypothesis. So then I went to look at the my bondage, my freedom. And I noticed the thing I had the hypothesis about moved into a different place in the text, it moved up. And then finally, by the life and times of Frederick Douglass, it's near the beginning. And it's the story of Frederick Douglass's mother. And this is a very powerful story. And it's something to bear in mind since we're talking about recognition issues. Frederick Douglass, as you know, enslaved children were taken away from their parents. They were put to a slave nanny, basically. And then when they're able to work, they were put on a plantation right away. So this happened with Frederick Douglass, and he was put on the plantation when he was around the age of 7. It turned out that he was about, I think it was 12 or somewhere between 12 and 20 miles away from where it turns out his biological mother was on another plantation. That woman, when she discovered her child was there, was on this plantation in Maryland, walked each night the distance. And a lot of people today, you know, we drive. We don't realize what it is for an enslaved woman to be walking at night 12 to 20 miles in Maryland to show up at another plantation. She could have been accused of whatever it may be. She walked to spend time with that 7-year-old child. And as she spent time, she did for 6 months and then she died. Now, the thing I ask my students, we have to understand how children are. If your mother is taken away from you, and everybody explained that, you know, the master was his father, and that's an abusive father already there, but your mother is taken away from you, no matter what the reasons were, a child experiences a form of anger about being abandoned, even though it wasn't the parents' fault. There are children, for instance, whose parents die in car accidents, and they blame the parents. Because children have this psychological thing that your parent is supposed to be there. Now, what's striking is this. Suddenly, your mother is there, and she's doing all this to spend time with you. Now, I ask my students, what would go through your mind if you discovered this, if this happened with you? And the students invariably get to the point to say, well, they realize the words, my mother loved me, right? Now, here's where the story gets interesting. You see, love is there's no accident if you look at a lot of Black literature. Black people talk a lot about love. And what is powerful here, why love is important here, is because the world told Frederick Douglass his value was as a commodity, as a tool to be used by a master or the other people with the license to own him. In other words, whites. Okay? And yeah, there were Black people who also owned slaves, but the fact of the matter is the structure in it was that from in the world he was in, any white person, even those who didn't own him, had a license over him.
And he was an extension of this in a way.
Correct. So this woman introduced a new conception of value into this child's life. Because in this love, this child realized that his value wasn't exclusively as his a commodity. The value, it's not property value. This is a person for whom the world is infinitely worse without him in it. Her act of love was to come. So she didn't realize this, but the love she was giving Frederick Douglass was to make him realize that he was valuable in a way that would make him uppity, etc. In other words, a revolutionary resistant. But here's the important part of the story, and this is how it connects to your question. If we stop the story there, we'd miss the point. And my students are often shocked when I say there's more to the story. And they try to figure out, I said, the issue isn't simply that his mother loved and valued him and brought the value of love into his life. The lesson he's to learn is to value being valued by her. In other words, he's in a world that says an enslaved person cannot and should not be a source of value. So you see, what made Frederick Douglass a revolutionary, or Fanon, or a lot of the Black revolutionaries we know, is that they valued being valued by us.
If they, yeah, you see, and that's the crucial thing. So your point about recognition is right on target. The extent to which we prioritize being valued by a system that dehumanizes us, we actually degrade ourselves and our communities as sources of value. We need to value being valued by each other.
This is going to lead to my last question, and I'm glad because it dovetailed perfectly, but we're getting to the end, and you know, I told you we'd keep this to an hour. So this is the last point, because you brought this up earlier. You said that you were very disappointed in how Black public intellectuals carried themselves on in this recent Bill Maher debacle. And things that came to my mind when I was looking at the debacle was, and it goes to another thing you said about our attention and just not giving our attention to everything and the value that comes from withholding our attention, is three or four Black people had to go and hold court and have Bill Maher hold court as they explained to him why what he did was wrong. And when I watched that, I was thinking, no matter what they say to him, how they quote-unquote check him, whatever, at the end of the day, he's important enough and he matters enough that three or four A-list Black people had to come and help him do his penance.
You know, this is, this. Well, there's several things. You know, in my book, Bad Faith and Anti-Black Racism, I'm very critical of even Black folks' use of that word. But the thing is, there's a distinction between using the word to talk or to degrade someone and referring to the word. And one of the things that struck me about this is that I noticed that Bill Maher's show, it's clear that Bill Maher takes seriously that he has a Black audience. And the reason is he always makes sure to have one of these Black public intellectuals on his show, because when they're on, it also leads to more Black people watching it. And so it's clear that for him, he sees himself as having a Black base. It struck me, however, that at the end of the day, the truth of the matter is that he is an individual who really didn't need that stuff. What I found disgusting about it is that this was their opportunity to have a way in having a large audience see them perform the role of being his HNICs. And I found that highly problematic. So for me, actually, Bill Maher is not really that relevant for me unless he says something that's of real value. But he's a grown man.
Exactly. Let him hold his own, let him take care of himself.
Yeah. But it's clear that this was their opportunity because, you know, it reminded me of a little joke from Bela Lugosi when he says to the filmmaker, Edward, I forget the last name, but first name was Eddie. Edward. He says, you know, Eddie, There's no such thing as bad press.
Bad publicity. and that goes back. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that goes back to the whole weaponized attention thing. Like, these people are that platform that he has, that attention, it becomes intoxicating. And he basically has different people there to play good cop, bad cop. Like, Dyson is a good cop. And then Ice Cube is there to be bad cop, to check him in the street kind of way. And then someone else is checking at him from a different, you know, it's almost like he's checking a list of, okay, this is how I'll, you know, redeem myself and use these Black people to do it. And
in existentialism, there's an expression called the will to power. The problem with the will to power is it's a clear indication that you have none.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? The bottom line, the main point is he chooses who comes to the show. He has the power. And so they're an expression of the will to power. But, you know, there's no shortage of gravy train will to power stuff. The bottom line is just that I actually don't lose it that much about the Dysons and the and the parade of different types that are thrown on that show. What really concerns me is Black folks who are invested in them performing those exactly. those acts. In other words, the sickness yes. is us. The extent to which we need to see Black people
represented,
perform the stimulation of white guilt, and part of this is an expression of a certain type of it's a certain kind of aggression. To be frank, if you think back to the privilege discourse, the reason there are Black people who like the privilege discourse is because. In a world in which there is no Black political power for, right, there's the immediate satisfaction in the capacity to make a white person yes. feel bad. You see, that's the aggression. But of course, fine, you make a white person feel bad, but the white person goes home still to a world of more support and structures than the Black person who made the white person feel bad has. So the problem is too many Black people are invested in that ritual of Black people who just simply get white people to feel good about feeling bad.
I want to add one thing to that. I don't think the white people, even though they technically feel bad, I feel like it's like S&M and masochism. Like someone might see the masochistic side of an S&M person, someone into bondage, and say, oh, this person must be a weakling. They must be somebody powerless who likes abuse and helplessness. But what I realized is that person is actually more power obsessed than most people. He's so power obsessed, he has to even control when he feels bad and when he feels powerless. So I think that white privileged person, he's feeling bad in quotation marks, but it's an acceptable bad that he's prescribed the limits to. He said, this is how bad you're going to let me feel. This is the kind of badness I want to feel. And your job is to provide me this type of controlled, manageable, bad feeling. So discourse.
You formulated it beautifully. That's exactly what I was saying. Totally. In fact, that's exactly what I was saying. Yeah, no. You, that's exactly the point. And in fact, the studies of masochism reveal that masochism is a secretly satisfying sense of control over the person who has to wage the aggression on the masochist, because that person now is now controlled yes. to keep the masochist
and
in the condition
keep them
of
happy.
Suffering.
It is optics look like the abuser's in control. But in reality, it's different. And I feel like it's the same thing in the white privilege discourse. It looks like these social justice types are abusing, you know, these masochistic whites. But the masochistic whites are the ones who really control that dynamic and the power of it. And you can tell, because if you start bringing up reparations or something that requires them raising their taxes or giving up real power, you know, suddenly they don't like feeling bad anymore. You know, they'll change their tunes fast.
Well, you hit the nail on the head in what does bother me about those displays, because what a lot of Black folks who do invest in seeing those displays don't realize, we're not witnessing Black strength, we're witnessing Black
yes.
weakness.
That's why I said it's a kind of a codependence, because codependents get their value from being recognized by the narcissist or the sociopath, and I feel like there's a bit of that.
Whereas someone like, you know, I mean, you know, there are certain contexts that are much different. The way Malcolm X, for instance, went about doing what he did, or the way Fanon yes. did what he did, and quite a few others. Because you see, although politics depends on speech, so they had to be in the public arena and they did speak. However, their speech wasn't about satisfying the narcissistic desires of power structures. Their speech, in fact, it wasn't even about a kind of gravy train or a kind of commodification or selling of themselves in that market. Their speech was actually linked to organizing the mechanisms through which Black communities can have a clear understanding of actions that yes. could lead to empowerment. And empowerment is, and you could probably tell the way I'm using empowerment is a lot like the way I use the question of freedom, because empowerment actually expands your capacity to act. It's a flourishing activity, whereas the will to power, the stuff I'm speaking about negatively, is retracting. The more when you speak, it points back to you. That's actually a sign of weakness.
Yes, and going to like Alfred Adler and Frantz Fanon, that will of power is inherently like childish. It's kind of like a tantrum. You know, it's a child's conception of what power is. Whereas what you described before, it has its own burdens, but it's a type of responsibility, a type of burden that'll help you grow, that will help you become a more responsible citizen.
Yeah, one time, because we've the context here doesn't allow it, but if we speak again in the future, we should just have a conversation on power, because there's a lot on power I would love to talk about. Today, unfortunately, the moment you say power, people think about just two European guys. They think about Foucault and Agamben. But they don't realize that the meditations on power you could find all the way back in the ancient, from ancient reflections of Muda Netter, the language of ancient Kemet or Egypt, all the way through to reflections among the Abyssinian philosophers, and you know, there's a whole history of discussions on power all the way through Asia and a lot of the world that's far richer than the very reductive and limited ones we have that links power exclusively to coercion. Power is also linked to power is a lot. There's a lot in power that's about life and the flourishing of life, and this is one of the things that Fanon understood. That the real issue is to make sure that the person who walks out of his office or the person with whom he collaborates in the field walks out in the world and more empowered and more affirmed in life than a person who is actually going to be alienated, retracted, and resigned to a form of living, in his language, living death. In fact, he referred to zombification. We need, in for him, the argument is to get a lot of the damned of the earth, a lot of the colonized of the earth, a lot of the racially subjected of the earth to step out of a zombified existence and actually become
Yes, that's beautifully put. And The last thing I want to say is, I think a big problem with that, I feel like with Jews, right? When Hitler and the Nazis dehumanized Jews and put them through their own Holocaust, the Jews had some kind of history, some existence that they knew before Nazism, before the Holocaust, that once the dehumanization, once the image making of Jews as subhuman was ended, they can just revert to that. They might be traumatized, but there was an old template or something that they remember in their lifetime to revert back to. And I think that's a real problem with the Middle Passage, is basically black people start with slavery. There's just like a snipping, a cut of everything that came before. So I think we need to, you know, go back to that pre-existence and, you know, see who we were back then. But I think for black people, the problem is they don't even want to revert to. The earliest thing is that.
The thing we should bear in mind is that that's not actually that's not the actual history. I know that's history offered us, but several things. The thing with the Jews you're referring to there is European Jews. That's a whole other story. Yeah, because, you know, I'm also a professor of Jewish studies. And one of the things I got to tell you is that it'll shock many people. It's amazing not only how many people don't know Jewish history, but I mean Jews don't know Jewish history. Most of the Jews actually on the planet are not white or of color. But this story, because it took place in Europe, was about European Jews, and because Europe is imperial and North America is imperial, wherever is imperial, get to tell their version of a story. And so that story is dominated a certain way. But So for Afro-Jews, for Jews all over the world, there is this, the reality of Jews is a lot more complicated story. Because a lot of people don't, for instance, realize how much of Jewish history is African history. There are a lot of people who don't really actually know that. And how much of Judaism is African.
Yes.
A lot of people don't know this. But the second part is, a lot of people actually were, the story of historical amnesia is actually, it's imposed amnesia because, you see, actually a lot of those who landed from the Middle Passage did know their histories, did fight for it, did most of the actual eradication and transformation of slavery. And Du Bois writes about this, was because Black people, knowing our history, fought. The problem is what dominates the articulation of the history in hegemonic society rewrites that history into white
yes.
agency. And that's why, and so there's an imposed notion of Black people that eventually led to many Black people who don't know their histories. But if you look at Black people, particularly in the 19th century, and particularly in certain parts of the Caribbean, they were writing books about African history. They knew their history. And this is because this is something people have to understand about the people who were enslaved and brought to the Americas. The imposed history, the hegemonic history, looks at those people as raw, brute material
yes.
and commodities. What those people really were skilled labor. And once, if we could teach enough people that the enslaved people from Africa had skills, just even think of how do you think of even Africa when you think of skills? Plantations that had skilled labor kidnapped and brought were able to flourish versus those who had actually grew their own enslaved and and kept them illiterate and brutalized them from
yes.
those skills. There's this fiction as if the people who came over weren't literate. A lot of those people could write. They could read. If you look in the movie 12 Years a Slave, that special, if you read the book, you'd see more. But the reason Solomon Northup had those irrigation techniques and skills was because his father was an African, was brought from Africa and taught him those skills. His engineering knowledge was from Africa. And so one of the things we need to do, and this is, of course, this is the task of people like myself or like yourself, because I consider you an educator with what you're doing with this program. Our task, our responsibility is to make that knowledge available. The more that we can understand our actual past, that we were agents of history, that our ancestors were skilled people who brought those skills and contributed to what led to the enrichment of this world, we need to understand that also, along with that, we also brought skills of our resistance. And those are what really played an important role is that we fought so hard that it made enslavement in the form it was structured no longer viable. And so we have to understand that we fought for our freedom and that we have to have the responsibility of also bringing to our descendants our actual history.
That's beautifully put. I can't add anything to that. It would be a disservice to even add anything. Thank you, Dr. Gordon. That was wonderful. And I would like to follow up one day to have that meditation on power. So one of these days, I'll reach out
Let's
to you.
Do it.
Yeah, for sure.
We'll
That's great. So enjoy the rest of your evening, Doctor, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, I look forward to talking to you too. And thank you. It was wonderful.
Oh, likewise. Take care.
Okay.